the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome back to our first edition of Lifetime Income from our summer recess. Welcome back, everybody. Hope you had a great summer vacation, but it's time to get back to business.
Indeed, it is. Welcome back. John Loeffler here, and our guest on the program today is going to be Roberta Robinson. She's a California Board Certified Specialist in Probate, Estate, and Trust Law. She helps families transfer assets to the next generation while avoiding opprobrious probate and minimizing taxes. And she's well known for her ability to explain complex ideas in a very, very clear manner, which today, Jim, is an asset. And our subject matter of the day today is...
Well, today we're going to address an issue that's facing, John, more and more retirees in retirement. You're seeing a number of articles written in financial publications about it. And that's really because of the boomers heading into retirement at a time that we're facing 0% interest rates. So do you have adequate income to last you in retirement? And especially with interest rates where they are today, you know, I'm just taking a look at my Bloomberg screen, and folks, we're still at, let's just round this off, 0.1% on a one-year treasury bill, and a two-year treasury note is at roughly about 0.5%, considering that 5 years ago, it was 5%. And if you're looking at bank CDs, it doesn't get much better. A one-year bank CD is 1.1%. And we'll talk about where you want to keep cash in a minute. But, John, I'll tell you, you know, this is what it's been a long time. And, you know, with interest rates at zero and the Fed indicating it's not in a hurry to raise interest rates anytime soon. So it's been a long time. You know, we could see retirees who have been retired or those that are retired face almost a decade long of 0% interest rates.
You know, that sounds a lot like the lost decade. Well, it was really, it's almost been two decades in Japan. We could be actually facing that type of a decade here. But, you know, we have all this talk, Jim, of Fed rate hikes next year. Everybody seems to be anticipating that. Now, wouldn't those Fed rate hikes raise rates on CDs and on money market funds? So wouldn't that be a good thing for people who are holding those instruments?
Well, it would, John, eventually, but it's not as much as you would think. And, you know, the Fed has made it pretty clear, and especially the Yellen Fed, that she is not in a hurry to raise interest rates. And you have to understand that most money market funds at mutual funds today, where a lot of people have money in cash, those mutual funds are actually losing money. It's almost like a loss leader because they can't charge fees. I just quoted what a one-year treasury bill is. It's less than 0.1%. So that's why you're probably getting 0.01% if you're in a money market fund. And there's also new SEC rules that are going into effect over the next 2 years where actually mutual funds are going to have to report at net asset value. So there's no longer going to be this constant $1 value. So if they go out long term and interest rates change and the value of the portfolio goes down, individuals could see the net asset value on their money market funds decline. And remember when in, what was it, 2004, when Greenspan began to raise interest rates, he did it in baby steps, a quarter of a point at a time. And I suspect when the Fed begins to raise interest rates, maybe they raise it a quarter of a point at a time. At two meetings, they sit and pause for a while, see the reaction in the market, what goes on, and then decide whether they're going to proceed. But I don't see them moving very quickly, just as Greenspan did. And there's just too much debt out there. So even if rates begin to rise, you know, the first thing the money market funds are going to do is try to make money because they've been running these things at a loss. They're really not covering their operating costs. So even if rates begin to rise, John, you could be in a low interest rate environment for the balance of this decade. And meanwhile, you got to understand the Fed's goal is to raise the inflation rate. They've got a target rate of 2%. A lot would argue that the rates are probably what you are facing on an individual basis are much higher than that. But you know what? It's going to erode purchasing power.
Well, that's the important thing that people understand. And it's sometimes very difficult to make that apparent to people that, yes, the dollar amount that's sitting in your account is still the same, but what it will buy is substantially less. And, you know, a lot of Americans, Jim, right now are still in cash. Maybe even worse, they're in bond funds that cut dividends last 5 years. So what do you do to survive? A lot of people have been really reluctant to jump off the shelf. They're huddling on the shelf in the middle of a storm, so to speak. They're staying in cash. They're in bond funds. And all of that's not sustainable because, as you mentioned, inflation is going to constantly be nibbling away at the value of those funds. You have to have some kind of a strategy.
Well, I mean, there's several things and strategies you can use, and let's talk about cash itself. John, there's nothing wrong with having cash. In fact, from a financial planning perspective, we always recommend our clients, depending if you're self-employed or, well, let's say you have both spouses working where one possible spouse could lose a job, you always want to keep 6 months to 1 year's worth of living expenses in cash. I mean, let's face it. Emergencies, you need to buy a new car, maybe you're taking a trip, and unexpected medical expenses, especially as you get older. So you still need cash around, and also for investment opportunities. I mean, we manage money and we always have some cash balances because if there's a market correction, and if you're fully invested, you don't want to make the decision, okay, what do I sell to buy something else? If you have cash, you can take advantage of these opportunities when they present themselves. So you still want to have some cash, John. I'm not against cash. You just don't want to keep everything in cash because you're not going to survive.
Well, that's true. And outside of emergency reserves, then what are you going to do? You have an environment here where we are at 0% interest rates. It's been 6 years now. I mean, think about that. And it looks like another 3 years going along at these relatively low rates, which will log out at a decade, just like you said. It's a Japanese decade, like the Japanese went for 2 decades. So something has to happen if you're going to avoid losing the value of your dollars.
There are a number of options, and there are a number of things that are practical. I mean, the obvious one that stands out is you delay retirement. Instead of retiring, if you don't have the funds, and especially, you know, maybe you don't have as much capital as you thought, or you had the capital you would thought, but with today's low interest rate environment, it just doesn't provide the income. So the first one is delay retirement. Now, the reason this is a favored approach, it does a number of things. Number one, it allows you to accumulate assets for a longer period of time. Number two, if you're working, you can delay taking your Social Security. And most people can wait to full retirement age at 66 when they get 100% of their Social Security benefits. And if you wait beyond age 66, every year that you wait, for most people, your Social Security benefits are going to go up 8% a year until you reach age 70. And the third factor, John, is by delaying retirement and working, not only do you get, let's say, a higher pension, you have more assets, you're not drawing down your assets and a higher Social Security, but the third thing is you're not drawing down on your assets. As many people have had to over the last 5 years because of low interest rates, they're dipping into principal.
Let's play devil's advocate here, though. If you really look at it, and we need to factor in inflation here, like if you retire at age 62, you'll still get about 80% of your retirement benefit. Is it better to take those years ahead of time and get less overall on a monthly basis rather than watching it erode by inflation by the time you get the full amount? Because I see some people doing that, and that's a real important question.
Yeah, sure you can. I mean, obviously, let's just take the average retirement age at age 65. You'd get most of your Social Security benefits. But let's say at age 65, your Social Security benefit was $20,000. Now, let's suppose instead of taking your Social Security of $20,000 at age 65, you waited to age 70, which would be 5 more years. Now, here's the big thing, John. By waiting 5 years, your Social Security benefit would go from $20,000 to $28,300. Now, that alone is a 41% increase of $8,300 a year. Now, just to put that in perspective, if you were investing at 3% today, let's say you were in a bond fund, you would need $275,000 of extra capital, not to mention the accumulation of capital to offset the benefit that this $8,300 would give you. And don't forget, it's indexed to inflation. So obviously indexing 28,300 is better than indexing 20,000.
Well, what about working part-time? A lot of people are retiring. Maybe they're even taking Social Security benefits, but they continue to work part-time.
Well, I mean, that's another option. I mean, the most important thing when you retire and you're thinking about adequate income is you got to break out your budget, as we've talked about here a number of times on the program, to your fixed expenses. This is what it costs you to live on a day-to-day basis. This is not talking about travel, luxuries, or extra items. And so you need to cover those fixed expenses. And the best way to do that, you want to make sure you have the income, is with pension or Social Security. Then you have investments, and really, your investments, think of them as the extra income that comes in that pays for hobbies, travel, you know, maybe you want to get toys, a sailboat, motor home, or whatever, camera, whatever your hobbies are. But that's where your investments come to play, and part-time work can really make the difference. I have a lot of clients that do just that, John, between Social Security, what they're getting on investments, and pension is basically covering their fixed expenses, but for the extra things like, you know, maybe taking a couple trips a year or their hobbies, they've found that working part-time really makes a difference. And we also know from medical studies that people that work part-time are more likely to live longer. And it's also the opportunity to try something new.
So part of the strategy is delaying retirement, working part-time. What about investment options? I mean, what about, say, for example, their only pension is really Social Security? How are they going to cover fixed expenses with that, given the fact that Social Security's cost of living increases are really very minimal?
Well, I mean, one investment option, which, you know, is essentially you're creating your own personal pension plan, and that's using an immediate annuity. And the thing about it is an immediate annuity is more reliable than a bond fund, because as we did an interview last year with Wayne Pfau at the American College, and he did a study on bond funds, stocks, and annuities. And the problem that many investors have seen, probably going back to the year 2000, is most bond funds, because interest rates have been coming down, they've seen their income drop every single year. So if you retired in the year 2000, you know, think of what's happened. Your income's probably dropped in half if you were in a bond fund, or even more. And Wayne Pfau found that immediate annuity is a more effective because, number one, it's guaranteed. It doesn't change like a bond fund. But essentially, John, it's the same thing that companies do. If you're working for a company today in the private sector and they say, all right, if you retire, here are your pension options. If you take it on your life, you're going to get X amount of dollars a month. Or if you take it on so much to your surviving spouse, you're going to get X dollars. All your company's really doing is taking a pot of money, going to an insurance company and saying, here's the person's age, here's their spouse's age, what can you give me with this money? That's essentially an immediate annuity. Okay, you're doing the same thing if you take part of your investment portfolio and turn it into an immediate annuity. You create a predictable source of income. In essence, you get something that is predictable, it doesn't change, you can't outlive it, it's guaranteed. In comparison to what a lot of people did is they went into bond funds, and over the last 5 or 6 years, they've seen their income come down, or even worse, if they were in bond funds at the beginning of the last decade, it's even been more horrific. I mean, I can remember in the year 2000, I could get 7 and 8%. There's no way I could get 7 and 8% today without taking undue risk.
In essence, creating your own pension plan then. This really touches home with me, Jim, because a similar thing happened with my own parents. My father passed away in 1981, and my mother didn't pass away until 2007. And what at the time my dad did, and he was an accountant, you know, so he had somewhat of a savoir-faire about money. He put everything in CDs. He did have some pensions, too, from his military pensions and other related issues and Social Security. But he also put things in CDs. For mom, and at the time, remember, they were getting a screaming return. Everybody loved it.
Oh, God, the good old days. Remember that? double digits and toasters and Vegematics.
Yes, and it was guaranteed, you know, by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, that type of thing. However, over time, and this is where my mom sort of fell down till I intervened, was that, okay, look, mom, that worked when dad passed away, but it's not working now. We have to do something different with that. And that's also the problem with inflation over time. Let's face it, Social Security and the pensions and things you may have set up may not keep up with the inflationary situation. Also, as a result of that, expenses are going to go up. So everything is dynamic. Nothing is static. Jim, I remember 50 years ago, it would almost be a static type of universe. And you could actually plan things on that basis. Now you can't do that. So you're going to have a fixed income. How are you going to cover what your expenses and other living items are going to be?
You know, John, you raise a good point there. And just to illustrate this, let's just take two levels of income, $40,000 a year and $60,000 a year. And let's just take an inflation rate of 3%. It's actually averaged about 3.5, but we'll just stick with 3. At $40,000 a year to live at a 3% inflation rate, you're going to need $54,000 in 10 years, $72,000 in 20, and get this, folks, $84,000 in 25 years. If you're living off $60,000 a year, roughly $5,000 a month, at a 3% inflation rate, you're going to need $81,000 in 10 years, $108,000 in 20, and $126,000 in 25 years. So the point you're making here is inflation is a big factor. And here's the thing, it usually escalates later on in life, and especially as you get into your 70s and 80s, and the main cost of that inflation that you're going to be facing at that time is rising medical expenses. One spouse could be in a retirement home, or you're going to be covering, as we've seen with Medicare, you're going to be covering a lot more of your expenses. And, you know, whether you're buying a supplemental insurance policy, those premiums are really going to start to escalate. So you have to have something to protect yourself.
So outside of continuing to work, throwing the cat out, you're on your own, puss. Downsizing, that's part of it, I guess. What's left then to cover expenses? I mean, it would seem that the only option is going to be investments, savings, spend down your principal, something along those lines.
You know, the real risk of spending down principal, as some retirees are running into, it gets risky because, John, you don't know how long you're going to live. The best option is to inflation-proof your portfolio. So the two best options that we have known over time to inflation-proof a portfolio is something like investment real estate, where you can raise the rents, or dividend-paying blue-chip stocks, which are more liquid. And that's one of my favorite options because, I mean, they call them blue chips for a reason. And dividends have always been a good portion of the return that comes from the stock market. We forgot about that in the crazy 90s. But you have to have something that's going to go up, because otherwise you are going to be facing the options that you mentioned. Either one, you're going to have to either live on less money, cut your budget, save more, or you're going to spend down principal. And you don't want to find yourself in that situation, especially when you get older and are facing the possibility of substantial medical expenses.
And the other risk that investors worry about is another market downturn. I mean, if you look at the fact we've had two bear markets in the last decade, and you remember the golden days, you're always talking about guaranteed income at a certain level. Well, this doesn't quite ride out the same way.
Well, I understand that. And of course, having gone through two bear markets in the last decade, but you know, John, that's normal. If you take a look at coming out of World War II from 1950, the business cycle lasted 4 to 5 years. You'd have 4 to 5 years of rising stocks. We get in a recession. There would be a bear market in stocks, usually a short one, and then we go back up again. So it's just that we went through the decade of the 80s and the 90s where stocks went up just about every single year. So people got used to that. The last decade, folks, it's normal to have a bull market. And there are extended periods of time like we had in the late 80s and the 90s where monetary policy is loose. Think of Alan Greenspan. Well, think of the last decade where it's loose, and think of where we are today. But here's the point. If you stick with blue chip stocks, the price of the stock may go down, but they don't get rid of the dividend. I'm talking about most of the blue chips. Now, obviously, the financials did during the crisis. But most stocks in the Dow, John, actually raised dividends every single year during the financial crisis. And let me just give you three. I'll look at Coca-Cola, Exxon, and Johnson & Johnson, healthcare consumer products, energy, and of course, a consumer company like Coke. In 2007, Coke raised its dividend per quarter from 15 cents to 17 cents. In 2008, they raised it to 19 cents. In 2009, the bottom of the crisis, they raised it to almost 21 cents, and today it's over 30. You take Exxon, in 2007, they raised the dividend from 32 cents to 35 cents a quarter. In 2008, in the crisis, they raised it to 40 cents, 2009 to 42, and today it's almost 70 cents. Johnson & Johnson, same thing, they raised it from 37 cents to a little over almost 42 cents in 2007, 46 cents in 2008, 49 cents in 2009, and 70 cents. So even during the worst crisis since the Great Depression, your income didn't change. And that's the important thing you have to remember here. Now, the stock price went down, but the income didn't change. And by the way, these high blue chip dividend stocks held up much better than riskier non-dividend paying or growth stocks did. And actually, I mean, imagine being in a financial crisis where the Fed is cutting interest rates to zero and you're getting a pay increase in the middle of a crisis. And if you take a look at since that crisis, John, every one of these stocks have doubled their dividends since 2007. So the important point is, how many retirees would like to see their income go up each year 7 to 10%? I don't know of too many pension funds. I don't care if you got a government pension fund or Social Security that are raising your income 7 to 10% a year. John, that's the best way I know to inflation-proof an investment portfolio.
You know, there's nothing like a real-world example because that shows how this actually plays out. And I know we have a case here. This came from a recent issue of Barron's, but something very specifically caught your attention in this article.
The guy's name is Marvin Najaberg, and this guy has been retired about 12 years. The name of the article, A Retirement Where Risk Rewards. Now, he's been retired about 12 years, and what caught me about this, and I'm just reading here from the article, he says, in 2006, Barron's published an essay I wrote about retiring comfortably with less than $1 million. For anyone who's curious, 8 years later, my investments and I are still doing fine. I'm older and grayer, but no wiser. And he had total retirement funds when he retired about $668,000. And he was investing heavily in third-party trust instruments, bonds in $25 increments, royalty trust, real estate investment trust. And so he made the decision to retire early. Then in 2008, he wrote a second installment to his retirement. Now, think of what was happening in 2008. We were in the middle of a crisis. In August of that year, it was the end of August, he wrote a piece called Surviving the Crash, a Progress Report. Okay, now brace yourself, folks. Now remember, he was taking a lot more risk with his retirement investments. So he said, at the time of my retirement, at the time he wrote his second installment, his portfolio dropped to 300. At the time he wrote the article on August 24th of 2009, his portfolio was back up to 450,000. His income was 50,000 instead of the original 60,000 that he was getting. Now, he just wrote this piece. This was August 30th, 2014. His investment portfolio is 800,000 and his income is 60,000. Now, he talked about his portfolio is probably less risky than it was when he was retired. He still has some second trust deeds. He has bonds in his portfolio, and he's gone to some stock mutual funds. And so here's a guy that had a plan, stuck with it, and he's been retired now for 12 years. He didn't panic. And he writes in the article, and he says, since I was managing my money myself, I didn't have to panic or sell at the bottom and get out of some of my investments. I held on to them, and they paid off. Some of his bonds got redeemed at par. Some of his preferred stocks were called. But even though he had stock market losses, pretty much his income allowed him to remain retired. And today, his portfolio is $800,000, which is roughly $112,000 more than when he started from, and his income is higher.
I know you had a similar case in your firm with a diversified portfolio. How did that hold up during the downturn?
Well, we put together a couple things, but what I wanted to do was illustrate, you know, what if you decided to invest at possibly the worst time you could think of, and that would be January 1, 2008. And had you put 50% of your portfolio in a laddered bond portfolio, you would have been getting, I don't know, somewhere between 4.5%, 5%, 40% in stocks, and 10% in cash. Now, what would have happened by March of 2009 is your bond portfolio was up 10%, so that's 50 grand. Your stock portfolio of 400,000, this is based on $1 million, your stock portfolio would have been down 120,000. Cash was cash. So at the worst bottom in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, you would have been down 7%. Now, all due respect for this gentleman, you know, had you just done nothing but a laddered bond portfolio of quality bonds, you would have had predictable income. Had you done blue chip stocks, you would have not suffered as severe a downturn, and your returns would have been a lot better. And there's a couple of ways that you could have done that. You could have done it with a laddered bond portfolio and blue chip stocks, or an immediate annuity in blue chip stocks. But the result is, instead of a bond fund, an annuity or a laddered bond portfolio would have given you predictable income. It wouldn't have changed. It would have been guaranteed. And you would have had less risk of income loss, unlike a bond fund or, let's say, keeping your money in cash or CDs. As you talked about, the experience your mom went through as interest rates went down over the decades, her income started to go down. And by choosing things like predictable blue chip stocks, I'm talking about the stocks that you would see in the Dow Jones Industrial Average or maybe in the top 100 stocks in the S&P 500, you would have less volatility. And especially if you stick with dividend stocks, they tend to hold up much better in a downturn, and you wouldn't have had as dramatic a downturn. This gentleman had some pretty high-risk investments in his portfolio, which is why he suffered a great downturn.
So there's a threefold strategy here to act in a 0% or close to 0% environment. Number one, delay retirement. Number two, you can work part-time while you are retired. Many people prefer to do that because it gives them purpose. Number three, you can inflation-proof your investments and diversify all of these things. So those are important. The most important thing being to have some kind of a plan. Otherwise, you tend to wallow forward. Coming up next, Roberta Robinson, California Board Certified Specialist in Probate, Estate, and Trust Law, explaining how parents can minimize the cost of moving things on to the next generation when they pass on. You'll find this to be an interesting discussion between Jim and Roberta.
Joining me on Lifetime Income this week is Roberta J. Robinson. She's a certified specialist in probate, estate, and trust law. And Roberta, last time I had you on the program, we were heading towards the fiscal cliff. We didn't know what the estate tax exemption was going to be. We didn't know what the tax rates were going to be. I mean, estate planning was really sort of in flux. We had no rules. Now we have them. I wonder if you could cover briefly what those rules are today as it applies to estate taxes.
Jim, we have a federal estate tax exemption. That's the amount an individual can leave free of what we call death taxes of $5,250,000. And that exemption will be indexed for inflation. So next year, if we have, I don't know, if we have 2% inflation this year, that exemption will go up next year. So instead of having a disappearing and reappearing exemption, we now have $5,250,000. That is also the exemption from gift tax. Now the estate and gift tax exemptions are unified. So if you wanted to, you could make a gift of $5.25 million this year, report that you made a gift, but have no gift tax due. For estates or gifts that go over the exemption, over $5.25 million, there is a tax of 40% on the amount that is over the exemption. So if you give me $6 million, there's going to be a 40% tax on $750,000, as an example.
And what about the annual gifting? Because I know, like, parents sometimes give gifts to grandchildren for college. What about the annual gifting that you can give to individuals, a husband and wife or a single individual?
The amount that can be gifted, which we call the annual gift tax exclusion, it can be gifted without even reporting it, is now $14,000. So a mother could give to her two children $14,000 each, and the father could give to the two children $14,000 each every year, and it starts all over again January 1st of next year. If, for instance, grandparents want to set up an educational fund for grandchildren, they can set up what we call the scholarship account or an educational fund and put in 5 years' worth of gifts up front. That's allowed without filing a gift tax return. So that would be 5 times 14 would be $60,000 could be put in from each grandparent into an educational fund. And as long as they live the next 5 years, they've made those gifts free of any transfer taxes.
Wow. That's not a bad thing when you consider the cost of college today.
That's right.
You know, Roberta, I want to move beyond the exemption today, and we're going to be calling this estate planning for the rich and famous, because I always wondered when I first got into this business 3 decades ago and I was studying to be a CFP, the tax rates were like 70% back in the early 80s before Ronald Reagan. They used to tax the estate on the death of the first spouse. And I always wondered why we had these large families like the Kennedys, the Vanderbilts, the Fords, all these wealthy families. How did they exist with 70% tax rates? So let's talk about, for a married couple today with a living trust, you get that exemption. You can use it twice, the $5.25 million for the husband and the $5.25 million for the wife. So for most people, most Americans, you know, there's $10,500,000. And I would say that would cover most Americans from estate taxes. What do you do when you move beyond that level? Because we do have families that have businesses or real estate holdings that may be worth way beyond that. However, it's the value of the business. And if estate taxes were to come in at a rate of 40%, how do you shelter that? Because a lot of times the businesses may not have the cash. Let's say you had a business that was worth $25 or $30 million. What do you do in situations like that?
Well, there are a variety of things. One, charitable giving is often a component of estate plans in very large estates. So we know there's the Bill and Melissa Gates Foundation. At a death, assets that are left to a family foundation such as that are not subject to estate tax. And we've heard of the Carnegie Foundation. So many family foundations, which is a corporation basically set up to make distributions to charities, and many families get involved. They want to be on the board of directors deciding where money is distributed. And in a family foundation, as long as 5% of the value of the foundation is distributed to a public charity annually, that is a charitable entity. And family members can work for the foundation to be on the board and, of course, try to achieve the charitable intent of the foundation. Another thing that happens to family businesses is that the estate tax can be paid in installments. So the government has a program where estate tax can be paid over a 15-year period if we have a family business. And the first 10 years, interest only, and the final 5 years, interest and principal. And because of inflation, paying a tax that's due in future dollars, 10, 15 years down the road, feels like a lower payment to the family that's having to make it. And of course, when we're dealing with large businesses, we're looking to see, can life insurance be obtained in order to pay the tax? We don't like to have to pay the tax, but is that a way of paying the tax with less dollars?
Yeah, because I know that, for example, you can do a life insurance trust where the life insurance is held outside the estate. So let's say the successor children, if they're working in the business, would have a tax-free check from the insurance company that they could simply hand over to the government to pay the estate taxes. Roberta, what about a charitable remainder trust? Let's say I'm in a situation where I'm over $10 million. And I have a highly appreciated asset. Maybe it's a stock that I invested in. You know, maybe I bought IBM, Apple, or something that has appreciated tremendously. I'd like to sell it, but because of now the 24% tax rate on capital gains, federal, plus the healthcare tax, and here in California we've got up to 13.3%, I'd like to sell it, but I don't want to pay the tax because I know I'm going to take a 40% hit. But I'd like to sell it, maybe invest it in something that produces income. Let's talk about the charitable remainder trust and how that works.
I think the charitable remainder trust is going to become a very popular vehicle. So a charitable remainder trust is what we call a split interest trust, where income is paid to one beneficiary and the principal or the remainder is paid to another beneficiary. In a charitable remainder trust, there's a stream of income that's paid out to the donor who sets it up or his family. The remainder, the principal, one day goes to charity. So, for example, let's say you have a stock, right, that's greatly appreciated. If you transfer the stock to a charitable remainder trust and keep a payout for a period of years, and the payout could be a certain dollar or annuity amount, or it could be a certain percentage of the trust every year, the stock can be sold inside the trust, and there is no capital gains tax due because it's exempt. The trust is exempt from income tax. And this is tremendous, as we have our great concern now for our higher capital gains tax rate and the new Medicare tax, and our California tax is high. So if someone has an appreciated asset, this is a way to sell it without current tax on the gain. What they give up, you might say, is that they don't totally own the asset. What they've retained is a payout for a period of years, which may be very nice. It's not for their lifetime, though. It's for a limited amount of time. At the end of the period, the principal, the remainder, must go to charity. And, you know, I don't like getting super technical, but the remainder that goes to charity has to be a 10% valuation of the trust. And we do all kinds of formulas to how do we calculate the remainder interest. In general, one of these trusts might go on for a period of about 20 years, not for the entire lifetime, but for a limited period. But it is a great way to sell an asset and keep the entire amount for reinvestment.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you take the capital gains rate with Obama tax, that's 24% here in California, add 13 to that, you're almost 40%. So let's say that I was fortunate enough to buy Apple at 14. Now, I wish I was. My son told me to buy it when I was at 14. I thought, what did he know? But anyway, let's say I bought Apple at 14. So this stock is worth $1 million. I transfer this $1 million to the charitable remainder trust, and let's say we're taking a 20-year payout period over this. Roberta, is there a tax deduction for doing that?
There is a tax deduction based on the remainder that's going to go to charity. So if we try to stretch out this trust as long as we can, we have to have a 10% remainder. So that would be $100,000 would be the remainder value going to charity. So there would be an income tax deduction of $100,000, not the full million, but at least something. And the biggest thing is that you still have the $1 million for reinvesting instead of only having, you know, $600,000 after tax.
Well, you know, when you think about it, let's take this $1 million example. Let's say that almost all of it is capital gains, just to make this illustration easier to understand. So I have $1 million worth of capital gains. In this case, I am going to be saving 40% in California and federal income taxes by donating it to the trust. So that's automatically $400,000. I don't have to pay to the government. If I sold it personally, I'd only have $600,000. In addition to that, let's assume I'm in the high tax bracket, which is 40%, and then also California, that's 13%. So let's just round it off and say it's 50%. That $100,000 deduction saves me $50,000 of taxes this year alone. So not only am I saving $400,000 in capital gains taxes, but I'm also getting a tax deduction of $50,000 as well. I mean, $450,000 on a $1 million asset. Roberta, that's quite nice.
It's astounding. And this is going to become so popular, I think, because of our increasing tax rates for capital gain. So everybody who has an asset with a large amount of capital gain in a large estate needs to think about this tool.
I want to talk about a case that was highly publicized because of its brilliance, and that was Jackie Onassis's estate, which was valued somewhere around $200 million at her death. She did something called a generation skipping tax. She did a life insurance trust. And as I recall, Roberta, on a $200 million estate, the shrinkage was like 1 or 2%, which is why the Kennedys are still a wealthy family today.
Yes. And even before Jackie Onassis, it was interesting to read about the Kennedys' ancestors. I think the grandfather also set up generation-skipping trusts. So let's spend a minute, I guess, and talk about generation-skipping trusts.
Okay.
If you want to set up a generation-skipping trust, the trust does not avoid estate tax in your estate. So at your death, we have to calculate, are you over the $5.25 million, and deal with that. But if those assets go into a trust for your children, for the rest of their lives, they can receive support, whatever you would like from that trust. And no matter what that trust grows to be in size, it could double, it could triple, it could be the Apple stock, it is protected from estate tax in their estate. So what's been skipped is the estate tax in the next generation. We didn't skip providing for the children, but we skipped having that trust taxed in their estate. So whenever I see an estate where a child or any beneficiary is going to receive maybe $1 million or more, I always suggest, would you like that to be inside of a generation skipping trust for that child? And how liberal it can be is that the child could actually be the trustee of the trust. The child could even have what we call a power of appointment to change the distribution plan of that trust, if you want the child to have it. The child can draw on income and principal for reasonable support. So it's very broad, but it's not part of the child's estate. You might say the burden of managing a trust like that is a trust tax return has to be filed every year for that trust. It has its own federal ID number. The assets need to remain under that ID number in that trust. But for large estates, it's a way to avoid an estate tax in the next generation. And I've even had children of my clients call, or their attorneys call me and say, please don't leave the bequest outright to my client, to the child. Please leave it in a generation skipping trust.
It not only is it you skip an entire generation, but you also can protect that child from divorce, splitting up of assets, other things that could occur within the family. And in the case of a business that you would like to see continuity, let's explain how you said that the estate taxes and the parents' trust who are creating this generation, they don't avoid estate taxes. But often what is used in this kind of situation is you have a, let's say, a life insurance trust where gifts are made to pay the estate taxes on the death of the parents in this generation skipping trust. So you have two strategies, taking care of the existing taxes and then avoiding a complete generation of taxes.
That's correct. So life insurance could be used to fund the generation skipping trust. In a life insurance trust, we say that loans can be made to the estate of the decedent. We cannot say that the life insurance is used to pay the estate tax. That would undo the tax planning. So we make loans to the estate, and then that trust can go on to provide for the children, for their lives, and ultimately go to the grandchildren.
Roberta, let's talk about some of the other tools that you use. In addition to, we have, let's say, life insurance trust. We have generation skipping trust. I mean, there is just a number of tools that most people are unaware of. It's sometimes tragic to see these large estates that get destroyed where there's no planning that has been done, because most people don't, I'm sure, even wealthy people, don't sit there each day and say, well, this is what my net worth is. Sometimes they're surprised when you value a business, you value real estate. Let's talk about that.
Well, there are many split interest trusts that we can use as tools. We talked about one of them, which is the charitable remainder trust, and that's a situation where there's an income stream to the person who sets it up. The remainder goes to charity. There are other kinds of split interest trusts. One is called a GRIT trust or a GRAT trust. We call that the grantor retained income or annuity trust. And here's an example. We had a client come in who had a candy business. This was the fourth generation of a closely held candy business, and this business was about to go public. and he wanted to give away enough stock to use up his exemption from estate tax. And his CPA said, go see Roberta to see if you can give away more than the exemption. Is there a way to give away more than what we think we can give tax-free? And I said, well, we can set up a grit trust, a trust in which you put the stock, retain a payout for a period of years, and after that period of years, that trust terminates and it goes to the children. So in this case, the retained interest was Dad, and the remainder went to the children. It stayed in the family. And why did we do this? Because when Dad gave away the stock, we valued the stock and then subtracted out the value of his retained interest. He wasn't giving away his retained interest. So we could give away $100,000 of stock, subtract out, for example, $40,000, and report to the government that he had made a $60,000 gift. And these trusts are approved. They're in the tax code. There's, you know, nothing questionable about that. And that's what we did. So we, at the time, the exemption was $600,000, but we were able to give away closer to $1 million in stock because it would be valued at $600,000. So these are very good trusts to give away assets to the family at a discounted value.
I was thinking of, you know, what case that came to mind was Sam Walton, who knew he had cancer, did something similar. He paid the estate taxes up front, figuring the growth of Walmart in terms of, talk about a super growth company, and he did that in the 90s, you know, when Walmart only had 50, 60 billion in sales. Today, Walmart has almost half a trillion in sales, and that's one of the reasons the Walton family collectively is one of the richest families in the country.
Well, that's growth.
Yeah, so let's talk further about this, because we do see a lot of businesses, individuals that they grow their business to the point where they're saying, I'd like to create some liquidity in my estate. We have a greater need for capital because we're expanding, so we're going to go public. And, I mean, just look what happened to Mark Zuckerberg.
Right.
I mean, yeah, so you see this quite often. And in these big families, these are the kind of things that they do.
That's right. And it's a very nice tool. When you think about it, it's a very straightforward and simple tool. You do have an ongoing irrevocable trust during the period where the income stream is being paid out to Dad, and you do have responsibilities for filing income tax returns and keeping the assets invested. And on the termination date, I find some clients sometimes forget about the termination date, but it really does terminate, and the assets would then be distributed according to the trust.
So we've talked about a number of things here. I want to move on to something that sort of ties this in. And Roberta, it's a pet peeve of mine that I've seen develop in my practice in the last 15 years, and I know you're concerned about it as well as you see this in your practice, is elder abuse. We had a situation a number of years ago where a gentleman was dying of cancer. He wanted to make sure his wife was taken care of because she didn't know how to follow the markets like he did. And so he set up he had a trust, transferred the accounts to us. And fortunately, after he passed on, about 6 months later, she met what I call Don, I'll call him Don Juan. And Don Juan wanted her to buy a new house, and they would go in jointly. She was going to put up most of the money. Thank goodness we talked her out of it. But what did happen later on was a son got involved in managing the assets. He got taken in by a broker. The account was transferred and it was put into this high load mutual fund with no break points, defeating entirely what he had in mind. And so many times we see in cases where a husband or one spouse wants to make sure the surviving spouse is taken care of. But you have family dynamics, you have elder abuse with children, you have financial abuse where unscrupulous financial advisors take advantage of an unsuspecting spouse. Let's talk about corporate trusteeship that is also tied in and becomes very, very important when you're talking about these larger estates.
Right, and it's tough during this period of recession that we've been in. I've had children come in with their elderly parents, not a lot of them, but I have seen some children, where they're more or less demanding that the parents give them gifts or that they should take over control of the parents' estate. And it's during these tough economic times that people really are stretched, and you might, I don't know, their ethics are stretched. And my personal theory is that everybody has a breaking point. It's just a matter of, you know, what degree of pressure does it take? So in many cases, I've talked straight to the child who's sitting in my office saying, you know, I'm not willing to do this. I don't recommend it for your parents. So oftentimes, children or close family members lose sight of what's in their own best interest and what's in their parents' best interest. And it's incredible to me how they can't see the line at some point. Using a corporate trustee or an outside trustee removes that possibility. And lots of times I breathe easier knowing there is an outside trustee, an unbiased trustee that's involved. And the family members, children, and other, you know, takers, what have you, may not get what they want and may not be in favor of that corporate trustee, but you might say that's the fortress that's protecting the client, that only the client's interests or the beneficiary's interests are really taken into consideration, and they don't have the biases of being within the family. So these are tough economic times. I hope we're starting to come out of this, but it's certainly been some of the fallout that I've seen during our recession.
And that's the one thing about a corporate trustee, and especially when there's a considerable amount of wealth involved. Roberta, I've seen situations where we have been asked to go into very high risk, high yielding investments, and the kids are talking mom as a result of these high yielding investments to start making annual gifts to them. As a result, not realizing that these high-yielding investments are high-yielding for a very reason. They are high-risk investments, and that is something that I think that a corporate trusteeship could protect against. Roberta, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the estate planning work that you do a lot of specialty work, not only in trust, probate, in trust law, but you also can take everything from a simple trust to the more complicated cases that we have been discussing today.
That's right. So I'm a certified specialist in trust, estate, and probate law here in California, and I'm actually on the state commission to promote certified specialists. So if I may, I'm even going to put in a plug for the State Bar of California, that we do have different specialty areas, and the public can look up specialists. Just like doctors, you can see who specializes and where are they located and what is their background by going to calbar.org. So here I'm going to promote the State Bar. And I am one of those specialists. I'm in Rancho Bernardo in San Diego, which is inland northern part of San Diego. And we have been in practice here 35, 36 years, so I like to think that I'm representing generations of people. I'm not just setting up this trust or that trust. I'm here for the long haul, and we're trying to take care of families, not only establishing the trusts, but the actual transfers through gifts after death, helping out the children, helping the grandchildren. And it's very rewarding to me to have that family continuity and those continuing relationships.
And if you would like to contact Roberta, her phone number is 858-485-1990, and her website is www.trustlaw.us. That's trustlaw.us. Roberta, I'd like to thank you for coming on the program and speaking to our listeners. All the best to you, and please come back and talk to us again.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Out of vacation now, Jim. I don't know if we ever really go on vacation. You've always got your head going in certain things. You ever notice that when you're on vacation? But anyway.
You know the best part about it, though, John? We used to joke about anytime we take the month of August off, something bad happens. Well, this August, about the only thing bad that happened here in California, it was bad. We had an earthquake up in wine country up in Napa Valley. But we had one of the best stock market Augusts that we had. All the predictions about a crash, you know, an imminent doom. Instead, the S&P was setting new records. So it's always surprising, but it was nice. But, you know, you and I are news junkies, and you just can't stay away from the news. Have you noticed that when you were on retirement? It was just like, you know, get up in the morning, I'm watching CNBC. You know, you come back from sailing at the end of the day, you turn on and take a look at our Bloomberg and take a look at what happened to the markets. I don't know. Once a news junkie, I guess always a news junkie.
Probably so. If people need to get in contact with you and they want more information or to talk to you about estate planning and related issues, how do they do that?
We have a toll-free number, 888-486-3939. Just give us a call and we can talk to you about setting up your own retirement plan.
That's 1-888-486-3939.
Well, in the meantime, we are out of time again. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.